Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Dr. Barbara Simons, argues that if we really want a secure election system in 2020, we need to go back to a paper-based voting system. According to a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice, an estimated 90% of Americans will cast their ballots on paper-based systems in 2020. That's compared with 80% in the 2016 election. But that leaves over 16 million people in 8 states voting on paperless machines. In many states, many electronic voting machines do not print paper records. Experts have long warned that these machines are a security risk because they don't allow election officials or the public to confirm vote totals. And in the recent election in Mississippi, we saw that votes were actually switched. So where are we today, and what will it take to actually secure our elections? Today, we're joined by Dr. Barbara Simons, board chair of Verified Voting. That's a nonpartisan nonprofit that advocates for legislation and regulation that promotes accuracy and transparency of elections. Dr. Simons is former president of the Association for Computing Machinery, the nation's largest educational and scientific computing society. She is the author of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? She also co-authored a report that led to the cancellation of the Department of Defense's Internet Voting Project in 2004 because of security concerns. Hi, Dr. Simons. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start off by thanking Jill Lavoie, who wrote a piece about you in The Atlantic, and that's how we first learned about your very important work, and we've been wanting to have you on for a while, so I'm really glad that we have you today. And Jill reported in her piece that you have been really fighting to go back to paper ballots for many, many years. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm a computer scientist, and basically the fight for paper ballots started with the computer science community because we know how computers can be unreliable. They could have software bugs or they could have malware. And the move to paperless voting systems, which was happening in the early 2000s, really disturbed a lot of my colleagues and me.
So why, can you explain and remind us, why did we move so quickly to paperless machines?
It was the result of Florida 2000 and also Florida 2002 primary, which was also messed up. But it was the hanging chads and all the problems with the punch cards that led a number of people to conclude that paper was a bad technology. That was the wrong conclusion. The conclusion should have been that the way the punch card systems were working was a bad technology. For example, there were some places where the chad trays weren't properly emptied, in many cases in minority communities. And so when people would push the place to vote, the chad wouldn't go out completely. So it wasn't a great technology to begin with, but the conclusion that paper was bad was just faulty.
And can you talk also just about the rush to embrace these machines? Over the years, we've done a lot of shows about the machines, about the companies. They're not widely known to a lot of people, about the hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts that went out to these machines, these companies that make the machines, I should say.
Well, as a result of the situation in Florida, in 2002, Congress passed a law called the Help America Vote Act, which provided over $3 billion, that's with a B, to states to modernize their voting equipment. So there was a bit of a gold rush mentality to, you know, go out and get the latest and greatest. And back then, people weren't so focused on security issues as we are now. This is, I say, in the early 2000s. And election officials wanted to be able to show to their voters that, look, we've got the best technology, we've got these great computers. And in addition, it was very appealing because for an election official, at the end of the day, all you had to do was push a button and get the results and go home. There was no recount. There were no messy paper ballots to have to deal with. It was fast and clean. And then finally, vendors were making claims about the security of their systems, which they really couldn't support it in reality.
How hackable are these machines today? On the website Verified Voting, where you are board chair, you have a New York Times video of J. Alex Halderman, who's University of Michigan computer science and engineering professor. And he held a mock election, and he was able to hack the system from his home computer. And the particular machines that he was hacking are AccuVote TS and TSX. These machines are still used in many states, including Florida, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. So how easy is it to hack these machines today?
Well, some are easier than others, obviously, but Alex is very good at hacking. By the way, he's also on our board of advisors. We work really closely with him. And the claim is often made by election officials that if the machines aren't attached to the Internet, that they're secure. And I know that Kim Vetter will be talking more about this in the second half of your show. But the fact is that there frequently are many ways to get to the machines, even so, because as Alex shows in that video, and I encourage your listeners to watch it, it's only 5 minutes, and it's a very impressive video. As he shows, when voting machines are run for each new election, well, this is both voting machines and scanners, by the way, because scanners are also computers. You have to program them for each new election. That means you have to tell the machine who the candidates are and what their locations are on the ballots. And this programming is done by a separate computer. It's not done by the voting machine itself or the scanner itself. You don't do it on those machines. You do it on a separate computer. And as Alex illustrates, these computers typically are attached to the Internet one way or another. If you can get a virus into one of these machines or to some of these machines, when they then provide the information to the voting machine or the scanner, you know, via, say, a memory card or something like that, a memory stick, that virus can be carried into the machine, and therefore the machine can be infected, as I say, even if it's never connected to the Internet. And for those of you who follow these things, you may remember back when the Iranian centrifuges were successfully hacked by a virus called Stuxnet. Those centrifuges were never attached to the Internet, but the hack was done through an intermediary, much the way I just described how a voting machine can be hacked.
Well, as you said, Kim Vetter will be joining us in about 30 minutes to talk about a recent piece she wrote for Vice about how election systems have been left online exposed despite denials. What about vote switching, Barbara? How often does this happen? There's a video going around showing a new voting machine in Mississippi, a recent election there, that actually switched votes. So if people were voting for Rose, the word Barbara just kept coming up.
Right. I've seen that video. I don't think those are quite the choices.
No, they weren't, but it's just...
Yeah, right. I don't know if the vote was actually switched or not, because what they saw was what the screen was showing. So it's quite possible that the screen, in fact, almost certainly the case, that the screen was out of calibration. And so when you pushed the Rose button, the Barbara button lit up. Now, does that mean that in the memory of the machine, Barbara is stored instead of Rose? I don't know. And there's no way to tell. So that's one of the problems. If you don't have a paper ballot, you can't know how the vote is actually stored inside the machine, because, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, computers really have many different components, and one component is the memory. What you see on the screen may not be what's stored in memory, but what's stored in memory is what gets counted. The same is true, incidentally, with Internet voting. What you see on the screen of your computer or your smartphone is not necessarily what gets sent out over the Internet.
So there's no way of knowing, because so many people are so skeptical of the system for these very reasons. And a lot of people wonder, is this politician who's in office, should he or she actually be there? Did they really win?
Right. Well, that's a very unhealthy situation, and that's among the many reasons why we have to get rid of these insecure or unreliable voting machines. That's one. I mean, we need to run evidence-based elections. We need to treat our elections the same way we would treat a reputable business, which needs to be audited. We need to audit our elections. We need to be able to check afterwards that the declared winners were actually the correct winners, or if there was a problem, we need to find that problem and fix it. The good news is we know how to do it. the bad news is we aren't really doing it yet, and that's one of the things that we're working very hard on to try to change that.
So we've got problems with the machines, and then you add in things that happened in Georgia, for example, like voter mm-hmm. purges, registration applications being mm-hmm. put on hold, problems with absentee and provisional ballots, and then you have people really not having much faith in the system at all. Georgia now plans to go 100% paper-based.
Right. Yeah, well, that's good news.
Right.
And by the way, you mentioned Pennsylvania, I think, is one of the, I believe, is one of the states with these machines that Alex hacked. By the way, those used to be called Diebold, for those of you who recognize that name. Those were Diebold machines before they were taken over by another company. Pennsylvania also is going 100% paperless, which is very, very good news, because in 2016 and 18, over 80% of the population of Pennsylvania, which is a key swing state, voted on insecure paperless voting machines, which is, in my view, a scandal.
So let's talk about paperless ballots. What does it take for mm-hmm. an entire state to go from paperless, a paperless system to a paper system?
Well, of course, first you need the financial resources to do it, and you need the determination to do it. Maryland did it in a relatively short period of time quite successfully. You need to not only purchase the machines, you need to train election officials and poll workers on how to use them, and also, of course, educate the public. The good news is when you move to paper ballots, frequently these ballots are something that voters are accustomed to. They could be fill in the oval, which people who've taken, you know, SATs know how to do, or connect a broken arrow, so two parts of a broken arrow, which is what we use in San Francisco. So intuitively, I think it's not that difficult for voters to learn how to use, to understand how to use. And some of what's going on is just resistance to change. Unfortunately, there are a few locations that have purchased new machines, new paperless machines, which I just find amazing.
How much money would it take to do this? Because Congress designated $380 million to states to help with upgrading their systems, and a progressive group called Stand Up America is spending over $100,000 on a campaign to pressure Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Republican senators to pass a bill to provide $600 million in election security funding.
I don't have an exact figure for you. I mean, if listeners are interested, we could maybe get that information for you and post it on your website. I am aware of the $380 million. That's actually money that had already been provided, which had already been allocated, and they just made it available. It was supposed to go to upgrading the security of these voting systems, but it was totally inadequate. For example, to give you a figure, Pennsylvania, as I say, is moving to entirely paper-based systems. The governor there is issuing $90 million worth of bonds to cover the cost. Now, that will cover not only the cost of purchase of the new systems, it'll cover, as I say, the training that's needed and the education that's needed so that everybody feels comfortable using them.
So let's talk about how paper ballot systems actually work.
Well, there are different kinds of paper ballot systems. So there's something called hand-marked paper ballots, which again is what I use when I vote in San Francisco, where I just go to the polls and I get this much too long ballot, because it's California,
right.
where I have to fill in the two sides of the broken arrow for my candidates. And then when I finish doing that, I put the ballot through the scanner, which is at the polling place. If the scanner thinks that I've voted too many times for something, like if they think I voted twice for president, if it thinks I voted twice for president, it should spit it out. So that's called an overvote. It should let me know, at least give me the option of getting a new ballot. It's also possible to program these scanners to let me know if I've undervoted, that is to say, skipped some race or other. But because people skip so many races intentionally, that generally is turned off. So what happens, I put it into the scanner, and the scanner reads the ballot and tabulates it and keeps it. But as I said, the scanner is a computer, and so it's not sufficient to have the paper ballot, because if something has happened to the scanner, we need to find that out. So we can't just stop with the paper ballots. We also have to do a post-election ballot audit that checks on these scanners.
So what would you, what else would you add to the scanner system?
Well, I'm not sure I would, by the way, there's another form of paper ballots, which I can talk about in a minute, but getting back to your question, I wouldn't add something to it. What we advocate, and by the way, this has also been advocated by the Senate Intelligence Committee, which in a report they released recently, and by the National Academies of Science in a report they released a few months ago. Basically, what the community is advocating is something called risk-limiting audits, which were actually developed by Philip Stark, who's a professor at UC Berkeley. He was chair of the Stat Department at the time. And what risk-limiting audits do is they randomly select ballots in general. They randomly select ballots and compare them to what the computer, which is the scanner, says to check that the scanner is behaving correctly. You keep on doing that. You start with a specific number, which depends on how close the race is and how much confidence you want in the result. And you keep at it until you either have convincing evidence that the candidate, the declared candidate, is actually the winner, or you end up doing a total manual recount because there's a problem and maybe the scanner wasn't right and you need to check it. That's what we need to do.
And for those of us who receive our ballots at home, a lot more people are doing that now. How are those votes counted?
Well, those are also counted by scanners in a central location. The problem with mail-in ballots is that you don't get the feedback. So if the scanner thinks you've double voted, too bad. You don't get another opportunity. So I would encourage people, when at all possible, to vote at the polls. Hmm. Also, a nice thing about polling place voting is that you eliminate the risk of voter coercion and vote buying.
That's so interesting, Dr. Simons, because we've done so many shows about this, and a lot of people point to Oregon, where mail-in ballots are, I believe, that's the only way people can vote, right? They don't have actual polling places in Oregon.
Yeah, I believe that's right.
Right. So you say that the best and most secure way to vote is to actually go to the polling place.
Yeah, that's my view. I know that there are a lot of advocates for home voting because they, you know, it makes it easier and so on. Like all things, there are, you know, pluses and minuses. And one of the minuses is you don't get the feedback on your ballot if there's a problem. And as I say, there's always the concern of voter coercion. I don't know how one proves that it hasn't happened. I think Oregon might, you know, probably it's not a big issue in Oregon. I worry a little bit about some of the other states in the union.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Barbara Simons. She is a computer scientist and board chair of Verified Voting, a nonpartisan nonprofit that advocates for legislation and regulation that promotes accuracy, transparency, and verifiability of elections. She's the author of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Today we're talking about voter security and what it will take to go back to paper-based voting systems. I mean, we're still having this conversation 19 years after the 2000 election. And let's go to Ruth Ann from El Cerrito, who has a question about mail-in ballots. Hi, Ruth Ann.
Good morning. I wanted to pick up on a comment one of the guests said. I vote permanently by mail. I'm a permanent vote-by-mail citizen. And I was curious or concerned last time that if I'm voting on paper and it's getting computed electronically, is there a possibility or probability that there will be a computer reading glitch?
Thanks for that question. Your mail-in ballot is the same as my ballot when I go to the polls. And it gets treated pretty much the same, except that, as I say, you don't get the feedback. And so your mail-in ballot will be counted by a scanner, just like mine is. And by the way, California does do a post-election ballot audit of 1%. A 1% manual check, which we've had as law since 1965, which was really progressive. I mean, California was the first state to do that. We don't have statewide risk limiting audits yet, however, although there have been a number of pilots throughout the country of them. So your ballot, assuming it doesn't get lost in the mail, should get basically the same treatment as mine.
All right.
It's not like you suffer disproportionately because it's mail-in. That shouldn't be the case.
Well, thank you for the call, Ruth Ann. We have an email from Tim who said, I would think the Democrats would be hammering away at our weakened voting system. Pretty sure all of the voting machine software comes from Republican donors that have repeatedly been shown to be easily hackable. Dr. Simons, do you know, is there one place we can go to find out who owns what voting machine and just where the money is flowing?
Well, if I could push back a little bit on that comment, if we have voter mark paper ballots, and by the way, there's another system that I should describe to you, but if we have voter mark paper ballots and post-election risk-limiting audits, we should catch problems. It doesn't matter who writes the software. We should be able to find out if there was a problem with the machines that counted. And therefore, you know, even if the devil himself wrote the software, that should get caught. So if we have the right processes in place, it doesn't matter really what the party affiliation is of the vendors.
So even if the machine was hacked, that should come up?
That's right. That's the reason we need post-election ballot audits, because the machine might be hacked. That's why we need it. We need evidence-based elections. Because we have the voter mark paper ballots that presumably the voter has checked, we can always go back to those paper ballots. And that's a way of bypassing the machine if the machine is really problematic.
Well, thank you for that email, Tim. Before we get to more calls, Dr. Simons, why don't you describe the other paper-based system?
Right. So there's something called ballot marking device, which basically, again, uses a computer to mark the ballot, to take the voter's selections, and then at the end prints out the voter's choices. And so that is a paper ballot. It gets put into a scanner, but it's not created by the voter taking a pencil or pen and marking the ballot. It's created by the machine. So these are relatively new devices. One of the reasons they were developed is that they can have good accessibility features that make them easier for voters with disabilities to use, or at least voters with vision problems to use. There are different machines on the market now. Some are really not very good because they don't give the voter much of an opportunity to validate the ballot, or they may not make it possible that it doesn't get validated at all, or the ballot gets put back underneath the printer again, and so malware could add additional votes, which would not be good. So some aren't very good and should not be purchased. Others, we're waiting to see how well they do. Los Angeles has a major project to develop one of these systems, which is very interesting, and people might like to go and check out what Los Angeles is doing. It's called VSAP. I forget what that stands for, but it's the VSAP system in Los Angeles.
Today we are speaking with Dr. Barbara Simons, Board Chair of Verified Voting. She's a computer scientist and author of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Today we are talking about election security and what it will take to go back to a paper-based voting system. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
A reminder that today's Your Call is a rebroadcast of a show we did a few weeks ago. We're not taking calls this morning, but we do appreciate your comments. You can email us to yourcall@kalw.org. Renee Kemp will be in tomorrow to host the program live. Ukraine will be the topic on 1A, 1/2 hour from now at 11 o'clock, right after Your Call, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea or feedback, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast. And please leave us a review at yourcallradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter to find out what's coming up at Your Call Radio. Today, we are talking about what it will take to secure our elections in 2020 and go back to a paper-based voting system. We're joined today by Dr. Barbara Simons, a computer scientist and board chair of Verified Voting. And now I would like to welcome Kim Zetter. Kim is an award-winning investigative journalist who's been covering these issues for more than a decade. Her work has been featured in a number of publications, including the New York Times. We had her on when she wrote a feature story called The Crisis of Election Security. And her latest piece for Vice's Motherboard is called Critical U.S. Election Systems Have Been Left Exposed Online Despite Official Denials. Hi, Kim. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you for joining us again. Kim, before we dive in and talk about your piece, what are your thoughts about this push to go back to a paper-based voting system? Next election, 90% of Americans will cast their ballots on paper-based systems, compared with 80% in 2016. So luckily, it's going up.
Yeah, but it's been a long time. I mean, when I started covering this in 2003, the push then was to get some kind of paper backup, if not an actual voter-marked paper ballot. And so it's taken us nearly two decades to reach this point. So it's been slow but sure. A lot of good work was done by Verified Voting. In fact, they were on the bandwagon from the very beginning to try and push for some kind of paper ballot. So it's good to see it actually happening.
Since you've been covering this for so long, why has it taken this long to get to this point?
Oh, well, I think that initially the problem was that the government made about $4 billion available to states back in 2002 to upgrade the voting equipment they had. But in the bill that passed that provided this money, they also included some deadlines for when the money had to be spent. And so election officials who were kind of clueless about technology were really at the mercy of voting machine vendors to push the system that would be the most expensive solution to them. And there was also a push to go paperless because the reason for Congress making this money available was because of the 2000 debacle in Florida with the dangling chads, the punch cards. And so there was this belief, an erroneous belief, that the paper was itself the problem, and not the kind of paper or the kind of paper-based system that we were using. And so election officials were convinced that paperless voting machines were the way to go and were more than happy to spend taxpayer money on it. And it was really hard to get them to switch.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about your new investigation, which focuses on this company, Election Systems and Software. You reported that in its election systems, they say that they've never been connected to the internet, and yet researchers found that 35 of the systems have been connected to the internet for months, even years. For those of us who aren't familiar with how these systems work, can you talk about the differences between systems that are connected to the internet and those that aren't?
Yeah, so this is involving systems that have modems or that use modems to transmit a result on election night. Not every county or state does this. And in fact, there are some states like California that actually prohibit using communications like this to transmit. So it's only in the case of at least this is what the story is about. There may be other systems that are connected to the internet, but this story that I wrote is primarily about systems that use these modems. They have embedded modems in them, or you can connect an external modem and transmit the results. Now, these are cellular modems, and for years, election officials and the vendors have been insisting that these cellular transmissions do not involve the internet. And that sounds logical. I mean, to an election official who doesn't know better, I can see them, sort of accepting that explanation that it's going over a cellular network and that's not the open internet. But in fact, cellular network traffic goes over the internet. And what I found and posted the story, one of the researchers who found this document in Rhode Island, it shows that ESNS it's a diagram basically showing the transmission of the votes via the cellular modem on election night. And it actually says on the ESNS created diagram, internet. So it goes from the modem and it says internet in big letters, for the transmission. So voting machine vendors have been telling election officials for years that the cellular modems do not involve internet connectivity. And yet their own documentation shows that it is, in fact, going over the internet. So I wrote a story about that last year for the New York Times, and that was in February 2018. And so a group of researchers decided, well, if the modems are transmitting results over the internet, there has to be something connected to the internet that's receiving it on the other end. And so they decided to go in search of these systems online to see if they could actually find them. And using open source information that described sort of the hardware and the software that is used for an ESNS system and for receiving those transmitted results, they sort of developed a footprint to look for online. And they were able to find 35 systems that match this footprint. Now, this has to come with a caveat. These systems can sometimes get put on the internet before an election and after, right after an election, and then taken off if they're just there for transmitting results. So they pop up on the internet and they pop off. And so when I say that they found 35, it's 35 that they could see over a period of time. It doesn't mean that those are the only systems that are connected. There may be many other systems that are connected that simply didn't show up on their search.
And you report that some of the systems have been online for a year or possibly longer. Some of them disappeared from the internet after the researchers notified an information sharing group for election officials last year. But at least 19 of the systems, including one in Florida's Miami-Dade County, were still connected to the internet when you wrote the piece on August 8th.
Yes. So, first of all, you shouldn't be connecting the systems to the internet at all. And that's why election officials and vendors say over and over again, these systems aren't connected to the internet, because they know that they shouldn't be. But if you are actually going to transmit results, then the system should only be connected for that brief period when you are transmitting results and then no other time. And what the researchers were finding, because they were doing these searches over a period of a year, what they were finding was that some of the systems were never leaving the internet. So they were on all the time. And the remarkable thing is that many election officials don't even know the systems are connected. They're not even aware of them. In part because vendors have told them they're not connected to the internet. In part because they're not necessarily in control of what gets turned on and what gets turned off. That's going to be, you know, a system administrator in an office somewhere. Or it could be a third-party company that they've hired to handle receiving votes on election night. So there are a lot of sort of problems with, one, the false information that election officials and the vendors have been feeding the public. And I just want to point out, they became very strident about asserting this before and after the 2016 election, when there was so much focus on the Russian hackers going after election systems that were connected to the internet. Those were primarily, what we know about were the voter registration databases. What we didn't know about, though, was that there were these other systems that were also connected to the internet. And it raises the possibility that while election officials and vendors were so stridently telling us these systems were never connected to the internet, it raises the possibility that Russian hackers had actually found or were looking for these systems on the internet.
So why would a company like Election Systems and Software, for example, tell officials that the system is not connected to the internet, knowing that it is?
Because they need to. Everyone needed to have the public have assurances that the systems were secure. So the primary goal of election officials is to secure the integrity of an election. But that doesn't necessarily mean actually mechanically securing the integrity of election as much as leading the public to believe that the elections have integrity. And that's quite often their primary concern, is to not lead voters to lose confidence in the outcome of an election. That's something that concerns them the most. Is that voters will not be confident in the outcome, and that voters then might not even actually show up to the polls to vote if they don't think that you can trust the outcome of an election. So that's the primary messaging, and that's the agenda, and those are the talking points. And so, you know, when it came up specifically, I want to point also, by the way, that people haven't been really concerned about whether the machines are connected to the internet. It hasn't come up because we've neglected the security of our elections for two decades. Wow. So when it started to come up in 2016, they had to quickly come up with a response when people were saying, but what about the Russians? And so the response that they come up with is, well, these systems aren't connected to the internet, so no one could ever hack them.
But why would the companies keep them connected to the internet?
For the transmission of these results. I mean, if you want to transmit results on election night, and election officials do want to do that because they want fast results, then you have to do it in some rapid manner. Ordinarily, what happens in California and other states that don't allow this, is there's a memory card on the voting machine that stores the votes during the voting period. When the election ends at the end of the day, the poll workers remove those memory cards and they drive them into a county office. And for some election officials or for the public who want rapid results, they think this is too slow. They also think that this rapid transmission of results actually lends it more integrity, because there's no time then for, if someone, let's say, is driving in that memory card and alters that memory card, you have a record of that early transmitted result that you can go back to and say, ah, someone changed those votes on the way. So it's a sort of an illogical way of thinking, however, because you've actually created another opportunity for someone to alter the votes when you're transmitting them that way.
Dr. Simons, what do you make of this, what Kim and these researchers found out?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's disturbing, and it's yet another example of how vulnerable our voting systems are. You know, in response to what Kim was just talking about with altering the memory cards, of course, that too is a vulnerability. But getting back again to an earlier question, since we have paper ballots, where we have them anyway, if we then do a risk-limiting audit afterwards, that should catch it. Of course, one of the concerns that we all have is that people will not trust the results because there'll be all these questions raised, even if we get them correct. And so, you know, we have to convince the public that our elections are accurate. And just one other quick comment responding to Kim's point about election officials wanting to convince the public that the results are correct. Election officials who have worked with us on pilot risk limiting audits really like them, because then they can really legitimately prove that the election results are correct.
We have a question about audits. Let's hear from Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for doing this subject. You know, the states who control the elections have a complete wide range of audit concepts, so there's definitely attention that needs to be paid there. But I wanted to say, ever since the beginning of the Help America Vote Act, there was the beginning to see forensic signs of disparities between exit polls and vote counts. And it was getting so bad that the companies, to stay in business, the poll companies, actually started adjusting their results in the favor of the Republicans, because if they're not accurate enough, they can't stay in business. But what it does appear to be is a very sophisticated, targeted program. Swing states in the high races and state legislators for the other offices, like the secretary and other offices that can affect, vote and election issues. So I just wanted to put it out. It's called redshifting, and the poll companies are actually having a hard time staying in business now. And now there's a campaign to get rid of exit polling altogether, saying they're worthless. And it's mostly because of this disparity. Last comment. Our State Department routinely considers elections in other countries with this amount of disparity, exit polls and vote counts, as fraud. Okay, that's a lot. I'll take a response. Thanks.
That is a lot. Dr. Simons, what's your response to Mark's comments?
Well, I hate to play a broken record, but if we have voter mark paper ballots and risk-limiting audits, we should be able to get the right results. One slight difference between auditing the paper ballots and exit polls is that occasionally, and I'm not disparaging what the caller said, because I know there are concerns about the exit polls, but sometimes people aren't honest or don't even remember how they voted, more likely not honest about it. With the paper ballots, they don't lie. So if you have the paper ballots, the voter mark paper ballots, and if you use them as checks, that should take care of these issues. I mean, again, that's really what we need to have, is voter mark paper ballots, strong chain of custody, and risk limiting audits.
Kim, what would you add?
There's not much that I can add to that. I mean, that's been the refrain for a long time. I'm sure that Barbara has talked about the fact that some states do have audits, like California has an audit and an auditing law right now, but the kinds of audits they're doing are insufficient. And so we've gone through this, you know, for two decades of trying to get to a point where we can actually trust the outcomes of elections. Initially by going from paperless voting machines to machines that produce a paper trail, but then never looking at that paper trail, and so it doesn't really help. And then we do audits, but we do the wrong kinds of audits, or we don't do a broad enough audit that is actually statistically significant that can actually show you if something has gone wrong. And so it's sort of been this rolling out stage by stage to where we're finally, we think that we've got the formula. Which is those voter marked paper ballots and a risk limiting audit. We're starting to see states implement that, Colorado, Rhode Island. And I think that there's a lot of interest nationwide now to do that. So it's taken a long time, but that is probably the best hope that we have.
Kim Zetter is an award-winning investigative journalist who has been writing about these issues for more than a decade. You can find her recent piece for Vice at yourcallradio.org. Critical U.S. election systems have been left exposed online despite official denials. We're also joined by Dr. Barbara Simons, a computer scientist and board chair of Verified Voting. She is also author of the book Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? She co-authored the report that led to the cancellation of the Department of Defense's Internet Voting Project in 2004 because of security concerns. Let's hear from a different Mark calling from San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm calling in because I think there should be a stronger case against ballot marking devices. I understand that ballot marking devices print out a paper version of what the voter enters on a touchscreen computer, and then the voter is supposed to validate the paper version, and then it's scanned. But there's two big problems with that. One is that study shows that people don't do a good job checking the paper ballots that are printed out, especially, you know, don't remember which judge they voted for with the long ballots. And then the other thing, which I haven't heard mentioned, is that they have a QR barcode on them, and that's what's really scanned in the next step. And of course, no human can read those. So as you've been saying, hand-marked paper ballots are a better and cheaper way to go. And then maybe at each polling place have, you know, one ballot marking device for people with disabilities that can't do the paper ballot. So what do you think about that?
Thank you. Dr. Simons, will you take that first?
Sure. So regarding the QR code on the ballots, if you do a risk-limiting audit, the audit looks at what the contents of the ballot, at the specific choices, not the QR code. So the risk-limiting audit has to be done by people manually looking at the ballots, not using the QR code. Now, as far as a study that the caller mentioned, there was an early study that was done using one particular system, and there's other work that's ongoing, both to look at how likely people are to validate the ballots if they're explicitly asked to do so, and also if the design of the system can encourage people to check their ballots. So I would say that that this issue has not been decided at this point. Based on one early study, I don't think we can conclude that people won't validate their ballots. It really depends, I think, on the way the system is designed and the way people are educated to check their ballots. And hopefully we can work this out so that people will validate their ballots, because I agree that's very important. That's a critical step. So, I agree with the caller that this is important, but I am not convinced that at this point we don't know how to design ballot marking devices where people will validate their ballots. And in fact, I know a lot of work in Los Angeles went into trying to do just that. Whether or not they succeeded remains to be seen. We'll have to see what additional studies show.
Kim, what would you add?
Well, I would, you know, Barbara was talking about when the risk limiting audit is done, it only looks at the voter readable part of the ballot and not the QR code. That's not necessarily a given. We're looking at federal legislation that would require audits and paper ballots. And there was a version of legislation that was going through last year that suddenly got changed at the end that would have allowed election officials to optionally do audits either through a machine or manually reading that ballot. So I think we have to be very specific with legislation as well that actually requires if you're going to do an audit, it is done only manually and is never done by using the machine readable portion.
I completely agree with what Kim just said. And I guess when I was talking about it, I was talking about what we advocate, and Kim says is absolutely right.
I know that every state and county has different rules around voting, but for the 16 million people in 8 states who will still vote on paperless machines, Dr. Simons, do you know, are there still laws on the books that say people can still request a paper ballot?
Well, it depends on the state. So I know that in Pennsylvania, back when they had a lot of paperless systems, which hopefully will be gone by 2020, it was difficult for people to make that request because of the way the law was written. In California, it's easy. So I really think it varies from state to state.
Right.
That's one of the issues, by the way, is that we don't have uniform high standards for our voting. This is done at the state level, and some states do a much better job than others. Some states do a really lousy job.
Right. What about old equipment? The Brennan report that just came out estimated that last November, 34% of all local election jurisdictions were using voting machines that were at least 10 years old. What are the risks there, Kim?
Well, we have a problem not just with the old voting machines, but old voting machine standards. So that even if you had a newer machine done, it was done to old standards, let's say dating back to 2005, that didn't actually require security. So the problem with having old machines are one that, you know, you wouldn't keep a laptop or your desktop computer for 20 years or 15 years, but that's what many of these states have is 15-year-old computers. For voting. So you've got old, outdated hardware. Many of them are running on operating systems that are 10 years old or more. Some of those systems are no longer, some of the operating systems are no longer supported by the software maker. And you're also just looking at, we know a lot more about computer security today than we did back in 2002. So even though the voting machine vendors didn't secure systems even to the level of what they should have been in 2002, they're certainly not secured to the level of what we would expect from a computer today in 2019.
In the piece you wrote last November for the New York Times, you focused on what hackers could do. They could target voters by deleting their names from the voting rolls or change their precincts to send them to the wrong location so their vote wouldn't end up counting. Are you still concerned about these things for the upcoming election?
Yeah, so there you're talking about the voter registration databases, and we know that those were the systems. We don't have a lot of proof of the Russian hackers going after the voting machines themselves or the back-end election systems, but what we do have, the only proof that we have right now, is that they did go after voter registration databases, and they got into some of them in those cases. And those voter registration databases, many of them were created in the same, you know, era that the voting machines were made. And when security wasn't quite at the level where it is today. So really there's a need to upgrade all of these systems. States need money for that. They need advice. They need oversight. I'm not sure that 2020 is going to be ready in the way that it should be. DHS has been working with states quite often on the voter registration databases. So there has been some work there, but DHS can't help everyone.
And Dr. Simons, what concerns you the most about the 2020 election when it comes to election security?
Oh, my. Well, I share Kim's concern about the voter registration databases. I mean, there are no national standards for them. And it's fortunate that DHS is working with the states. But again, they're vulnerable. Another concern is, even though we don't know that the voting machines or the vote tabulating systems have been successfully attacked in 2016, we have no information that they were. We know that Russia was probing around our voting systems quite a bit, and one thing that can happen is that, I mean, we have to worry that they were poking around looking for holes that they could take advantage of at a later time, or even conceivably implanting malware on various locations with the voter registration databases or the voting systems. So I think our voting systems still are far too insecure in every respect, and we need to focus on making them secure. We need to focus on voter mark paper ballots. And we need to focus on discriminating audits. I know I keep on saying this over and over again, but I think and with the voter registration databases, we really need to have strong requirements. We need to have help for the election officials. And one other quick comment: with all of this going on, we have local election officials who are underfunded, under-resourced, have very little access to any kind of security expertise, and they are trying to cope with all of this technology and not being provided proper tools.
Well, Dorothy in Berkeley, I'm sorry we don't have time to take your call, but Dorothy wanted to know what states are still resisting paper. Those states are Texas, Louisiana, Tennessee, Mississippi, Kansas, Indiana, Kentucky, and New Jersey. 16 million people in those 8 states will still vote on paperless machines in 2020. 90% of Americans will vote on paper-based systems. And we will Did you want to jump in there? Just quickly, yes.
If people want to know what kinds of systems are used in the various states and localities, we have a map of the United States at Verified Voting. If you go to verifiedvoting.org and click on the verifier, you can drill down to the localities and find out exactly what kinds of systems are being used throughout the country.
Okay, thank you so much. And we will continue following this issue. Thanks to our guest today. Dr. Barbara Simons is a computer scientist and board chair of Verified Voting. She's also former president of the Association for Computing Machinery and author of Broken Ballots, Will Your Vote Count? Dr. Simons, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Kim Zetter is an award-winning investigative journalist who has been covering these issues for more than a decade. You can find her latest piece at Your Call Radio. She wrote it for Vice. It's called Critical U.S. Election Systems Have Been Left Exposed Online Despite Official Denials. Kim, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find more information about what it will take to secure the vote at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us. This is Your Call.